This is Paul Hurt of Arizona State University with Jennifer Sweeney, Research Associate at Arizona State University. And we are interviewing with Jack Schmidt in Logan, Utah on June 11th of 2018. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
Can you just start out by giving us your full name, the positions that you held in the Adaptive Management Program over time, and the years in which you were involved?
Well, my legal name is John C. Schmidt. I go by Jack. I served in an official capacity with the program as chief of the Grand Canyon Monitoring Research Center from August 2011.
I saw your memo.
I'm going through the numbers, but that doesn't work out. August 2011 until November 1st of 2014. Mm-hmm.
But you were involved.
Yeah, but that. I have long. So the longer involvement, I did my first river research trip in spring of 1984.
Colorado River?
My first river research trip in Grand Canyon. Uh-huh. With the USGS to help and look for a research opportunity. I was subsequently funded. That's its own story. And I did my first research trip affiliated with the USGS in May of 1985. Mm. I pursued my dissertation, completed that in 1987, stayed working for the USGS another approximately 9 months. Took an academic position.
Was that here at Utah State?
Middlebury College in Vermont. Mm-hmm. Stayed active at a time when I was not getting any direct funding from the program in the late 1980s, and that's its own story. Served as an advisor on sediment and geomorphology issues to Duncan Patton, who was senior scientist, right? And so,
are you a geologist, by the way?
I'm a geomorphologist.
Geomorphologist, yeah. Okay.
So I did have an active position then, but that was before the Adaptive Management Program existed.
Right.
I guess to back up, in the late 1980s, before I went to Middlebury, I was part of the team that wrote the phase one final report of the GCES program. So I was that sediment guy. Uh-huh. So then I served as an advisor to Duncan in the early 1990s. So I was involved extensively in the development of the interim flow recommendations in the early 1990s. The conception of the Grand Canyon Protection Act, the discussions that went on behind the scenes that ultimately led to the creation of the Adaptive Management Program. I was one of a group of probably five people who originally thought up the idea of controlled floods and worked extensively in the early 1990s to get that implemented. Once the Adaptive Management Program was created and GCMRC was created, And after the first flood was occurred, I actually had more limited involvement. Mm-hmm. I would I knew what was going on, my grad students. I've been involved in lots of ways and continue to write papers. And so I had probably a reduced involvement as somebody who was part of the funded academic group until I became chief.
When you were... I forgot my question. I had a question right in my mind, and it just slipped out the window. So we'll just go to question number two then.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you when you came to Utah State University for
September of 1991. Yeah.
And were you doing research along the river in the canyon when the floods of, I think that was 1993, there were some large floods that came through? Is that about the time that you started thinking that we should maybe create some artificial floods because of your observation of the effects of some of those large El Nino-type flood events?
No, that's not really how it worked. God, this is so hard to tell this. It's such an involved... Give me like two or three. I'm tempted to just tell you a historical story start.
All right. Well, the next question was, which of the three main components of the program were you mostly involved in? That scientific research would be, and then policy and management is the second component, and social and institutional engagement, like representing stakeholders, is the third. Did you do all three?
Certainly the first two all the time. Let me just try to tell you my story. The program has evolved. When the program, I gave a talk this in Flagstaff just last month on sort of the history of scientific ideas in Grand Canyon and how they've evolved and but I can give you the PowerPoint slides.
That'd be great.
So if you look back at the 1970s and you look at the inception of GCES, it was focused on the effects of hydropower generation on the downstream environment. And the lawsuit that created GCES was all about what's going to be the effect of bigger fluctuations, it morphed into what are the large scale operational effects of the dam. Mm-hmm. The most notable incident that I remember from I was just a guy who'd gone back later in life to get a PhD. I was going to do a dissertation in Montana. I wanted to go back home to Montana after I got my dissertation done. And through a set of connections, an influential fellow in the USGS and friend of mine, when I said to him, well, are there any other dissertation topics you can think that I might want to work on? And he said, well, I think we could get you involved in this brand new program that the USGS is going to get involved in Grand Canyon. And
was that before the GCMRC? This is in
1980. No, this is a decade before.
Okay.
Yeah. And I never looked back, and that's what I did. And at that point in the program, in the early, 1980s, when GCES was created, you basically had this unwanted, irrelevant fish biologist who, you know, they sent out, who they let go to Flagstaff to go run something that Reclamation considered harmless.
Was this Duncan Patton?
No. No. Wagner.
Dave Wagner.
Yeah, of course. Okay. I mean,
he was a fish biologist.
Yeah. Okay. And meanwhile, because all of that would be harmless.
All right.
And stuff that really mattered, like modeling sediment transport or something, was going to be done by the USGS in the traditional alliance between Reclamation and USGS that has been part of those agencies' history for a century. And it's a testament to the fact that Reclamation thought this was all pretty irrelevant by the fact that they would let somebody go to Flagstaff and create an office. Little did they know what would happen. So to placate the environmental interests, there were nominal questions listed, like what will be the long-term fate of sandbars. But, and so I showed up at the USGS and they said, well, we don't know what you would do, but here are some questions we're supposed to answer. And so I said, okay, I'll work on the sandbar question. After I looked around Grand Canyon, I wrote a grant proposal, submitted it to Wagner. Wagner said he would fund it. Then the USGS said, well, if you're going to be funded to work on this, then you'll work for us. So I, as a graduate student out of Johns Hopkins, ended up saying, okay, I'll do my dissertation through the USGS, not because they care, I mean, just because they demanded it. Mm-hmm. And so I did my dissertation as a hydrologist for the USGS as a graduate student completing this dissertation. And I had, and there was a USGS scientist who was nominally my boss, and we were, I mean, she administered it, and we wouldn't get out of here if I started telling you.
Was that all in Flagstaff?
Ironically, when I headed back to Arizona to start that, I assumed I'd be living in Flagstaff. Mm-hmm. But the state office of the USGS was in Tucson. And so I was told I was living in Tucson, which is something about sort of the control and sensitivity of these things. Mm-hmm. But so with that woman, I'm out on the river one time, and what was distinctive about is that we had the great 1983 floods.
Yeah.
And then we had really high releases in 1984 and 1985. Yeah. And I was down on somebody else's USGS trip just helping, and I were making some comment after a couple days about our need to study what this 45,000 cubic foot per second flow was doing to the river. And this person dressed me down, and in no uncertain terms, she said to me, we will not study this. We have a responsibility to study what is the effect of increasing the range of power peaking from a high releases of 31,000 to high releases of 33,500 CFS, and that's what we'll study. So
why do you think she was that rigid about the program?
Because that was what Reclamation said. I mean, so okay. It's a reminder that the focus was on hydro peaking, and the high flows of the 80s were not understood, well, were viewed as a an anomaly, and really just an impediment to study what needed to be studied. That's how much the issue has moved over time. And so I mean, I did my thing in the midst of that in late 1985 and early 1986. Reclamation had to schedule a special period of hydropeaking so that we could measure what its effects were. And they didn't want to hydropeak. They didn't want to hydropeak because they had so much water they wanted to get out of the reservoir, and they had so much snow in the mountains. And they scheduled this 4-month period, and we measured and studied it. And in fact, they bailed 3.5 months into the study because it was snowing again and they needed to abandon it. So the important thing is that those studies went on explicitly to study the effects of hydropeaking. And the issue was too much water, and it completely changed the operations. And but it's a focus that everything was about hydropeaking. Of course, the other goofiness, it was about how do we preserve a trout fishery? You know, it was, you know, the, I mean, there's all, you know, and oh, hydropeaking must be bad for trout because trout spawning is adversely affected when the reds are dried every. So I mean, it's this complete hodgepodge of different values. So anyway, it was the National Research Council. Well, so I, like other scientists at that time, although we were increasingly aware of what had the floods done, there was this drive that we're focused on hydropeaking. And so there was a drive that we looked and understood our science in the context of what would limiting hydropeaking do to make for less erosion. And there were lots of studies done by lots of people that sort of looked at those issues. It took some external reviewers from the National Research Council to point out that the issues of erosion and maintaining sandbars can't just be about limiting hydropeaking. You've got to also rebuild those deposits. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, my research contributed it, you know. Let's stop for a minute. This is a problem with Mesa. She's just completely ramped. Let's just take a quick second.
Remember where you were?
Floods. Okay. So the National Research Council observed that, reminded us all, that any geologic deposit and its status at any time is both a result of the history of erosion but also the history of deposition. And that river deposits do have to go underwater at some time if they're going to ever be rebuilt. And in the early 90s, the innovative discussions were held in Duncan's offices amongst some key people, and those people were Ned Andrews of the USGS, Jim Smith of the USGS, Dick Marzoff of the USGS, Dave Rubin of the USGS, and myself. And I would say that probably at the beginning, Rubin and I were the most skeptical. And I would say that Andrews and Smith and Marzoff were more strongly advocating for floods from the get-go. And So I'm always careful to say I'm lucky enough to be part of a group of people who conceived of this. And no one person ever dreams these things up. I'm not going to go through the history of all that went on in the early 90s. Are you familiar? There's a book called The Controlled Flood in Grand Canyon that is an AGU monograph that is Robert H. Webb. It's Webb, Schmidt, and Valdez, I think. I'm not sure. It's something like that, published in 1999. It's an AGU monograph. I mean, it's certainly one of the seminal publications of the controlled flooding Grand Canyon. It's certainly one of the seminal publications of the program. And I wrote a chapter in that book called The History of the Controlled Flood, you know, how it came to be. And everybody's a co-author, including Wegner. And so rather than walk through all of that, I mean, that's published. And that's gone through peer review. But what's important there is that, you know, I tell the story. That's an idea that came out of scientists. And the guys at the USGS in the early 90s would propose that every year. Larry Stevens was very much against the idea of the flood. Dave Wegner was very much against the idea of the flood. And they fought it behind the scenes relentlessly every year.
Is that because they assumed that floods would only cause erosion and not deposition, do you think?
It was a mix of well-intentioned scientific reasons and who was in political control. And when it was proposed as a USGS-led science effort, Wegner fought hard against it. And so we were almost, and we would used to, I mean, in the early 90s, we would sort of, year after year, we would sort of conceive of who was going to do what. And so...
And the funding, you know, at that time was coming from where?
It was helter skelter.
Okay.
USGS was investing money. In the late 1980s, I led two winter research trips to measure sandbar erosion in the late 80s, funded on the backs of tuition from kids at Middlebury, because Wegner wouldn't give me a dime. Because, you know, it's a sad thing about Grand Canyon. I mean, everybody fights for the money. The agencies all want to be in control. You know, there's a difficulty of who's going to be, you know, just who. I mean, political control is just a big thing. Whatever the case, I think that I write about that in a more politically acceptable way, you know, in this article that I wrote. But the reality is, after two or three years of failed efforts to get the flood implemented, because you had to line up all the politics and all that, finally enough people thought it was their idea. And how do you get anything done in the world? You gotta convince other people that it's their idea. And if you go around now, I could tell you NGO people who think they dreamed up the flood, and different people in agencies who used to run agencies, for all I know, they think they dreamed up the flood, and that's all fine.
And that,
but we're on record that, I mean, that flood idea arose probably in 92 or something, and it took us 4 years to get that implemented. And, you know, and it occurred in 96.
So that was the first quote-unquote high-flow event?
Yes.
Okay.
Which is just administrative gobbledygook. It's a controlled flood.
Right.
But for, you know. The one other thing that just in the past that's not written about, I should say, is that in the late 1980s, on one of those on the first winter trip when we were down there after the high flows of the 80s, we'd gone into high hydropeaking in the late 80s. I mean, I couldn't get any money out of reclamation to work there anymore, so I would go there in the winter because I still cared about it. There was lots of erosion going on, and so one night sitting at Eminence Break Camp in Marble Canyon, after days of, you know, a week of measuring this stuff, we got sitting around the fire, we got worked up, and so we sort of conceived of and wrote in my field book the beach bill, we called it, to protect the beaches of Grand Canyon. And that was me and my students, Dave Rubin, Johnny Moore from the University of Montana, Tom Moody, Dan Durker, both river guides, and we sort of collectively wrote this thing.
How long?
And that was in
that?
Like, that would have been in probably January of 89.
And for how long had you known that the dam operations were leading to the loss, the erosion and loss of beaches? Was that just a few years?
No. That's a longer history. I mean, the first scientific article that described that erosion was published in 1974.
Wow.
So the perception that hydropeaking played a role in that erosion went way back. The issue is now very nuanced in that we now understand that hydropeaking plays some role, but it's also clear, you know, it's bigger issues of sediment mass balance, the absence of supply, things like that.
Right.
But just to go back, just because these pieces of the administrative history are important, we came out of that, and I got back to my office at Middlebury, got on the phone to Ed Norton, the head of the Grand Canyon Trust. He told me to get lost, that they didn't need any legislation, that they were going to work with reclamation to get an environmental impact statement produced. So I don't take no for an answer. So then I contacted Tom Jensen, who was the chief of staff for the Senate Natural Resources Committee, and said, this is what's needed. He was sympathetic. I wrote him a letter, you know, typed up the whole thing from my field books, corresponded with him, and then worked all of that spring to write a report, you know, Middlebury College Department of Geology series number one or something, describing all that. And then it turned out, ironically, that Senator Bill Bradley was the convocation speaker at Middlebury that spring. So we all waited around.
Was he on the Natural Resources Committee?
He was the chair of it.
He was the chairman.
He was Jensen's boss. And Jensen, of course, goes on to become, he leaves the Senate that and becomes head of Grand Canyon Trust after. So anyway, this was all led out of by Dan Beard and Tom Jensen to get the Grand Canyon Protection Act. Anyway, so in May at Middlebury, we had the glossy report, and the university college let us do this, and I had three students, you know, with me, and we stood behind the bleachers, and Bradley gets out of the limo coming down from the Burlington Airport, and, you know, we all shake hands, and, you know, Bill Bradley's a big imposing basketball player, and at some point, you know, I just, you know, everybody sort of stammers for a minute, and then I sort of kick the kid next to me, and, well, Senator Bradley, we know you're a great friend of the environment, and we've been working in the Grand Canyon, and we wanted to share with you this report in which we describe the sandbar erosion in Grand Canyon, and we'd like you to be, and so then we said a few things, and Bradley said, you know, some nice things, and on we went. And little did I know that within the month, he flew out to Grand Canyon to do a field review with Grand Canyon Trust, and he got off the plane with our report having been circled and said, what's going on? And I have somewhere in my files a letter of thank you from Tom Jensen telling me, you know, when the Grand Canyon Protection Act was passed, knowing that I played a role in getting that going. Now, it's like everything else. Everybody else claims their own credit for it. But I know that in the late 80s, I kept the idea alive. And that's my style. My style is that I call it the way I see it, but I just don't write a science report. I go somewhere with it. Anyway, so that's just that piece of that story. The other thing that went on in the mid-1990s as the Adaptive Management Program was being created was those of us who were senior scientists at that time began to realize that the program was pretty aimless and trying to be all things to all people. And so we got together and wrote what is surely one of the most influential papers that guides the program, called Science and Values in the Grand Canyon, or Science and Values in Restoring the Grand Canyon. That was published in Bioscience in 1998. And that list, it's Schmidt et al., but it's Schmidt and Webb and Valdez and Marzoff and Stevens. And it basically says, we can give you any kind of Colorado River and Grand Canyon that you want, and the problem isn't science. You just have to decide what you want. And we don't think you know what you want. And that paper is still read. That paper is read around the country by classes still, and that paper is read, by people who understand the history of these issues ever since. So, in some ways,
can I go back to that please. Quote for a second?
Yeah.
Because I read that in the memo that you sent me that you wrote in 2014 as you were leaving. And I was struck by that quote. I think it's really profound. And I was going to ask you if you would elaborate a little bit on that. When you were there in the early years, what did people want from a program, and how did that change over time? Did we ever get clarity, or was it always a muddle? Did it change as values or policies changed? Well, how do you see the evolution of that whole challenge?
You know, it's interesting. When I teach courses in this stuff, I often say that when you tell the history of water development in the West, and you tell the story about how in the 1950s, the key decisions about building dams and diversions were made by the technical elite, of engineers, lawyers, civic boosters, mm-hmm. corporate agriculture. Mm-hmm. Isn't this a much better world that now everybody's at the table? And then you turn it on students and say, well, is it really a better world, or have we just made the world infinitely more muddled? Mm-hmm. At the time, Wegner had a clear directive that I think came out of administrative guidance and maybe even out of court rulings. I'm not sure. He surely knows the stuff by heart. So the issues were sandbars, trout, endangered fish, maybe riparian vegetation. I think those are the four. Or maybe it's recreation. It's maybe it's four, maybe it's five. It's damn simple. Now, there was, now, you know, probably the GCES phase one taught us more about what we didn't know than what we knew. But whatever the case, we were forced to make little matrices where you had some kind of operational decision, some environmental outcome, and you had pluses or minuses, or you don't know. And I think that that's where the perception that not everything benefited by the same operational decision started to, like, become clear to people. But it wasn't until that bioscience article that we made a huge table and systematically put pluses and minuses, and then it became clear that there was no operational scheme that benefited everything.
Right.
And if there was no operational scheme that benefited everything, then you darn well better know what you wanted. Mm-hmm. And so then an idea that's in that article that I get credit for because I'm the senior author and I've got a lot of mileage at it, but the idea was Dick Marzoff's, not mine, was he coined the terms relict resources and artifact resources. Relics of the past and artifacts of dams. And Dick thought this up, and then I, you know, we all jump, you know how we all work in academia, right? And I've gotten so much mileage out of this, and so many slides, and so many talks, I can't even keep track of them, in which you, so we had those ideas, right? That, you know, folks, some of the environmental resources down there are the relics of the past, and other resources are artifacts of dams. The most obvious being trout, recreational trout fishery, right, as an artifact of that. So then, I will confess that I got quite frustrated. When the adaptive management program was first created, I got, from afar, I got quite frustrated by it because it just instantly wanted to make everything more complicated. Mm-hmm. And so then, you have all these stakeholders, and all these stakeholders have their pet resources they care about. And then I, there's a focus in these adaptive management programs and these stakeholder processes in people getting along. And I used to flippantly criticize the program because I would cynically say that, you know, it became this whole trust-building exercise and fall backwards into each other's arms to learn to trust the other person and all this stuff that goes on, and nobody would make hard-nosed decisions. And so what happened was a set of and then let's get all the stakeholders to write objectives for the program. And they, so this became cannon fodder for me giving talks, because I would show a slide in which all these objectives would be listed, all written by the stakeholders, and there was 16 or 20 of them or something, I don't know. And then the next slide, I would just have the same list, except, you know, in one color would be relics of the past, and the other color would be artifacts of the dam, and under artifacts dam would be a recreational trout fishery and maximum hydropower production and secure water supply, and then it was just like, and then, you know, well, folks, this, you can't do this. This is not a hard problem. We can do really sophisticated science, but it isn't actually that hard a problem. For starters, we can't do all this. We need to make a tougher decision.
Because you're saying basically there are trade-offs.
You can't have it all.
Right. Somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose.
So where I began to, so I became, I guess, a critiquer of the program. Mm-hmm. to go back.
Is that because you wanted them to start making trade-offs and making decisions, and it was taking too long to establish
all
a collaborative?
I have my personal biases of what I'd like planet Earth to look like, but I don't get to choose how many billion people live on the Earth's surface or how many hundred millions live in the United States. And I mean, you can't have this, you know, magical natural paradise and have however many people we have. So trade-offs are going to have to be made. I just felt like tough decisions weren't... There was tough thinking that was... We had made such progress in the early 90s to get to the idea of the controlled flood, and then we were losing it because everybody cared about just how they all got along. Hmm. And
which was delaying decisions, the process.
I don't know. Government moves so slow. I don't know. I just wasn't a big fan of that. Mm-hmm. But I would say that, you know, my experience and the experience, the early 1990s were a unique time. They were a unique time because I flippantly sometimes refer to that as those were the years when the traditional water managers and reclamation lost control of the dam. And this small group of scientists sitting in Duncan Patton's office actually just sat around and dreamed up, oh, let's have interim operations. Let's reduce the range of fluctuations. And the political forces, largely set up by Wegener, pushed those things through. And reclamation and the traditional stakeholders hated it. Mm-hmm. And so by the time the adaptive management program was created in 96 or 97, it was like, we're doing this as a formal process. This is going to be formal. This is a federal advisory committee. We're not going to have this tyranny or anarchy of scientists running the show. And, you know, if I sat in a room with Rick Gold, who was a commissioner then, you know, I mean, or the regional director then, I mean, I don't think actually that it would be all that, I think everybody would sort of agree with that. So there was something, the adaptive management program transformed what some might call anarchy into a very formalized process. Others might say stultifying. Yeah. Others might say ossified, you know. And so, you know, who am I? This is what happens with any government agency. I mean, EPA was a wonderful place the first couple of, you know, then it becomes a different kind of a place. The Office of Surface Mining, I had worked in the first years it was organized in the Carter administration. It becomes a much more, this is just what happens. So the fact that that's what happened when the adaptive management program was formalized is not, I don't know that that's good or bad. It's mm-hmm. just what happens. In the legislation that, in the record of decision of the EIS, what was created was a formal adapt. It was formally called an adaptive management program. And after the first hiccup, you know, of the first head of chief of GCMRC, a guy named Dave Garrett, who wasn't there very long before he had to leave for health problems.
We're meeting him in August at his home in Colorado.
Said to my, yeah, he runs a winery.
Really?
Yeah, if you don't, you might do a stop and go here, but for heaven's sakes, don't make the same mistake in there. make sure you tell your families you need to spend 2 full days talking with Dave on this back deck, having a glass of rosé or whatever. Don't waste that trip. Anyway, but then after Dave had health problems and had to leave, the second chief, Barry Gold, was a real disciple of adaptive management. And then they brought in, you know, the international expert on adaptive management. What could possibly be wrong with that? And so so they bring in Carl. And, you know, Carl's a pretty strong-headed, my way or the highway kind of guy. Doesn't take guff from anybody. And he's a real straight shooter. He's internationally respected, written books. I mean, he's a force. And he had a vision of how everything was going to work. And that vision of how it was going to work was that they could create models of all these trade-offs. Mm. And then if you made everything transparent, of course stakeholders are going to make the informed decision, and you can start to evaluate the trade-offs, and you can start to evaluate whether you really need to know X or Y or Z. And so they went down the path of building a big ecosystem model. And, you know, and the metaphor I use is that, you know, so they invited a whole bunch of experts in every different field, and they locked them in a room, and, you know, and Carl, you know, and his crew would say, okay, well, what's this relationship between flow and fish populations or sandbars or something? And if the scientists would say, well, we can't tell you that one. Then he'd say, well, okay, well, you know, we're locking you in. I don't care how long it takes you, but you're not getting out of the room. You're not getting another hamburger until you tell me whether it's going up or down. And so, you know, and so out of that, you know, it's just like we're not going to just let scientists just forever, you know, study things. Right. Like, damn it, we're going to get something out of you. And so they did it, and they built an ecosystem model, and you could run trade-offs and do whatever, and as soon as that came out, the stakeholders, you know, immediately ignored it. And it had no impact on decision-making.
Why? Why did they ignore it?
Because you cannot practice adaptive management in Grand Canyon. In the literature, and I wrote about it in one of those memos I sent you, in the literature, the circumstances in Grand Canyon are at best described literally as adaptive management light, which means you're either trying to practice adaptive management or you're pretending to practice adaptive management in a context in which there are major societal actions that cannot be experimentally adjusted. Hmm. The most fundamental in Grand Canyon is that you must pass an explicit amount of water from the upper basin to the lower basin, from Lake Powell to Lake Mead. Hmm. And you can't tweak that. And there are large external forces relative to water supply that must be acknowledged and respected and cannot be manipulated. Mm-hmm. And so, and there are large institutional forces that control those decisions. And those institutional forces of water supply are never going to let go of their control and give it to the issues of Grand Canyon. And so you're never going to be able to practice adaptive management.
Because that requires experimental research, and there are certain experiments that are out of the realm of possibility, you're saying.
And not only that, you can't adapt, you cannot maintain a fixed experimental program, you know, for 10 or 20 years, because the world changes. We go into a protracted drought. We have 5 years of wet years in the eight, and everything goes right out the window. But anyway, that's, so that went on, and then, you know, the tension, just to finish the thought, I mean, then the, there was a focus at adaptive management. GCMRC as an agency was viewed as, its objective was to be a small contracting agency that let contracts for academics and consultants to do research, applied research, that the role of GCMRC was to write guidance documents in planning and adaptive management. That was certainly the paradigm of gold. The whole GCMRC gets absorbed into the USGS. There's intrigue with all of these things and long stories, and then all the way through my predecessor, that was a focus of the agency, or that's a focus of GCMRC, and then I came in and said, well, that's great, but we're not going in that direction anymore, we're going in this direction, and then...
And that new direction was?
I guess twofold. I said the science questions that GCMRC is asking that are coming from the stakeholders are myopic, unanswerable, complex, and intractable. And I would go to occasional meetings of GCMRC, annual reporting meetings of the Adaptive Management Program, in the years before I became chief, and people would come up to me in the back of the room and say, you know, Jack, it's great to see you. Yeah, isn't this just crazy what it's become? And it was just a demoralized, it was just a demoralized operation in which people sat and...
What was the source of that demoralization?
Nobody knew what the questions were. Nobody knew what they were supposed to be working on. Nobody knew where they were going.
So there was no direction. There was just...
No science. No. This is the adaptive management program. I'm not...
Okay.
The science aid. I'm not talking... I'm talking about the program itself. Because, so I just went in and said, we can't articulate, that's not how it can work. The way it has to work is that the job of GCMRC is to re-articulate science questions as big, simple questions, so that every stakeholder, if asked, what are you studying and why do you exist? Every stakeholder will tell you basically the same thing because everybody understands it. And so
what would be an example of that kind of simple, direct kind of question?
So I used to put them up in all my talks. It was like, this program is about answering these three questions or these two questions. This is all we're trying to do. If it's not relentlessly fixed on this, we got to ask ourselves, why do we do this? Yeah, the two fundamental questions for Grand Canyon are, is it, I mean, every one is a nuanced question, but the first one is it possible? No, what is the size, the maximum size of sandbars that can be maintained with the existing tremendous deficit in sand supply and given the operational rules that exist? And is that size acceptable to society? And the other question is something like, what is the maximum population of the endangered humpback chub that can be maintained given the fact that society, that we have made a societal decision to also maintain a recreational trout fishery when those trout eat the endangered fish? Now, there are the fish one is much more nuanced now. Yeah. Now there's razorback suckers along with humpback chub. Now it's brown trout rather than rainbow trout. Now it might be that operations don't make a hill of beans a difference. But it's just that. You work with the administration and you get guidance. Well, what you do is you sort of clue the high administration to, like, we'd like to receive a memo that says this, and they say, well, would you like to share with us any paragraphs that you'd like to, wouldn't mind seeing show up in a letter on this, you know, and that's the game you play. But we would get memos from the assistant secretary that said, well, we know you have a lot of things to work on, but just to be clear, it's sand, fish. That's what you're working on. Yeah. So that effort to simplify, those would come in the time I was there.
In 2011 to 2014.
So one thing is make it simple, make it so everyone can articulate it, and that the job of GCMRC is to listen in a sensitive and caring and careful way to the expression of stakeholders, what they're saying are their concerns, and then to be able to be clear enough to talk back to a stakeholder and say, okay, I hear your concern, and this is the scientific question that I think you're asking. Or to say back to a stakeholder, well, what you're asking is a really hard and nuanced question. And anytime you're trying to answer a hard and nuanced question in science, then it will cost you much, much more to answer it. That's just how it works. And you need to understand, you need to ask yourself whether you really need that question answered. Because the resources it would take to answer that are probably not reasonable. Or to say to a stakeholder, that's a great question, that's exactly tractable. Or to say, I don't think that's the question you really want to ask. Here's a question, and this is a tractable one. Or perhaps even just as important, it is to say, I hear your concern, but we can't tell you any more than we have told you already. You need to make a decision. We're past the point. Because what happens in these programs is that you know, I keep going in these segues. Okay, so one big thing is the resources that people care about in Grand Canyon, their artifacts or relics, right? Mm. Another big categorization is the categorization of the stakeholders. The stakeholders, some of the stakeholders represent institutions and perspectives for whom their agendas and goals are met if radical and big change occurs in operating rules. And the other group is those institutions and groups who benefit because the status quo is maintained. And so when you have a program that has two fundamental groups, and the groups for whom this, if the status quo is maintained, they benefit, happen to also be the most politically powerful people sitting around the table, and those are the people who are paid real salaries to sit there at the table, right? Then what's the game you play? Well, I'm not convinced. I think we need to study that some more. Here's another alternative that might be plausible. We really should study this other possibility before we take an action. And you endlessly delay decisions because you can always come up with some other question or some other nuance. And the problem in Grand Canyon is that there's always some young, hungry academic or some young, hungry agency person who will say, you bet, I'll take that on.
Yeah. More research.
I'm an old guy. I have colleagues who are my ilk who would look at me in years past and say, Schmidt, I can't believe you still work in Grand Canyon. You figured it out. You know what the solutions are. There's not a societal will to solve the problems. Why do you take their money? Can't you? Are you incapable of coming up with anything else to work on? You know, just have enough nerve to walk away and go studying something else. And one of the dilemmas in Grand Canyon is that the game of stakeholders asking ever more nuanced, silly questions is perpetuated. And in a world in which research money is hard to come by, or just maintaining, you know, GCMRC as an institution, you know, somebody's going to say, oh, I'll take that question on. So anyway, my agenda at GCM, that's one thing, was big questions. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was internal to GCMRC. I said, GCMRC cannot be an agency staffed by people who write contracts. That if that's what you do, you can't manage excellent science unless you are yourself an excellent scientist. And so I remember one of my former students who is down there now. When he was hired down there, I was a prof. He left here to go down there. And he was the finalist for the job. And at the time, you know, the biggest concern within GCMRC about whether to hire that guy is they were concerned that he might be too much of a scientist and he might want to actually do science. And he needed to understand that, no, he's coming down to run a program and write contracts.
Contracts for research.
Yeah, for someone else to do it. Right. Yeah. And so I just said, we're not doing that. And so the other big change that I made at GCMRC was saying, no, we're going to convert all these people to what are called RGE scientists. They're basically, within the USGS, you're a research-grade evaluation scientist. I would not, as chief, control whether you get a promotion. You are evaluated for a promotion by an external national committee of your peers. And they could care less what you do in your day-to-day work. You're either producing at the rate at which you would justify tenure or promotion in an academic arena, or you're not. And so I took it out of my hands. And then I just said, well, you're on your own now. You better produce. And then the other one is that, you know, in GCMR, so there are multiple people who come up to me and thank me for having their words save their career, put them on a path of research.
At GCMRC.
At GCMRC today. And the other one was that I happened to be chief at a time of financial relative abundance. Anybody looks good in a time, right? A rising tide floats all boats. So my job was a hell of a lot easier than the job now. But because of that, I was able to hire a number of postdocs because that was based on the philosophy. My philosophy was, you know, it's hard to I was trying to inspire people. I couldn't inspire everybody. You can only pull that off. So they're federal employees. You can't fire them. All that sort of stuff. And so in an effort to inspire the place, I filled it with postdocs.
Young, hungry.
And it was just like, okay, get some people swimming fast. And then maybe other people will swim fast. And, you know, and anyway, so those are the two, those are the two big changes that I'm proud of. It was easier because there was money available to do it.
So it sounds to me a little bit like you're very aware of and concerned about the tension between administrators needing to make important decisions about dam operations, trade-offs between resources, while at the same time attempting to be collaborative and democratic and participatory, that there's a tension between those two. And that you feel that maybe we need to bite the bullet a little more often, be less like conflict averse, and be more willing to just say, okay, this is what we want, these are the decisions we're going to make, and not like sort of endlessly worry about all stakeholders being represented and satisfied. Is that?
To some extent, yes.
It's a universal challenge in every agency.
There are big realizations that I came to in that position. One of them was the realization that Grand Canyon as a segment of the river is trapped. It is prisoner of the fact that if you think of the big map of the Colorado River watershed, you essentially have everything in the upper basin, the land where the water comes from. And then everything below Hoover is the land where the water goes, the land where the water is used. And connecting those two is the bottleneck. Every drop of water from the land where the water comes from to the land where the water is used must pass through Grand Canyon. And so your management options in Grand Canyon are tiny.
Very constrained.
Tiny. And that all became clear to me in the development of the long-term experiment management program, EIS, the LTEMP EIS, when well-intentioned personal friends of mine, who I like and remain friends with today and who were my bosses in Washington, D.C., right? Just completely took off the table every fundamental decision that would really affect the place. You're not going to mess with the compact. You're not going to mess, you know, with any law of the river administrative agreements. You're not going to touch the 2007 interim shortage guidelines. You're not, you know, and so every water supply agreement that is in place is untouchable. Then for good measure, they said, and you're not going to touch sediment augmentation. We would never get that. You're not going to touch temperature manipulation. You would never achieve that. Now, make the best of it. So what happened, so
but I... did let you mess with hydropower generation?
Of course. So the irony is that in the long arc of this issue started with a focus on hydropower because nobody understood it to be anything other than hydropower. We then came to realize, no, it's sediment supply. It's the lack of sediment supply. It's the absence of floods. It's the absence of rebuilding of the deposits. Hydropeaking is one part of it, but it's a small piece of a bigger, harder puzzle. Hmm. But then it turns out that every other piece of the puzzle, water supply routing, sediment trapping in Lake Powell, temperature modification, are all off limits. And so the only whipping boy you're left with is hydropower, is everybody's whipping boy. And so ironically, no one who knew me would ever perceive me as an apologist for hydropower. And yet I actually believe that hydropower now always has to make the compromise because they're the easy fall guy for much bigger problems. Mm-hmm. And that's the crazy... So my big thing now, what I work on with trying to do grants and writing articles and stuff, is... And I've given these talks in lots of places in which I sort of talk about what are the big changes we're willing to make, what are the big changes we're not willing to make. The problem in Grand Canyon is we're stuck on hydropeaking. And so that's a problem. And so I'm focused now in my work at trying to make sure that when the interim shortage guidelines are reopened for renegotiation in 2020, the river and the river environment is on the table. It is a clear piece of the conversation, because the way things have worked over the last 20 years is every deal is cut amongst the water supply players. Mm-hmm. And then after you cut all the deals, then you get on the phone to GCMRC and say, okay, we cut all the deals now.
What can you do?
Make the best of this, but you can't touch the deal we just cut.
Yeah. So what do you think we want for the river and the river ecosystem?
Yeah, so that's a great... Okay.
How would we get...
Okay. So given the fact that we're locked in, mm-hmm. right, then what do we want? I still do think that different stakeholders want different things. I think the National Park Service just wants control. I'm not even sure they care what they want. They just want to feel like they're in control. And they're never going to be in control, because it's the state's water managed by the national government to allocate for 40 million people. And so they just want some say. So that's sort of, but they just are insulted by the fact that, you know, they manage the sides of the ditch and the bottleneck. It's clearly understandable how the most important thing that the stakeholders almost universally agree on is they can't allow any endangered species to blink out. Okay. Because that would bring compliance from, that would bring on court-ordered environmental compliance.
Yeah.
So there is, so...
One more reduction of flexibility.
So there's that is myopically first among equals. So ironically, you might have thought it was sand or something. It's the population of humpback chub. And now it's also potentially, you know, this population of razorback suckers. But it's ESA compliant species. Mm-hmm. That is head and shoulders above anything else. Mm. It's not about... It, well, that's it. Then, I think it's arguable whether the next tier down is sandbars for camping, or it's just whatever kind of a river ecosystem makes sure that those species don't blink out. But to me, mm-hmm. what's not on that list is a natural native river ecosystem. Mm-hmm. That's nobody.
Does that come automatically? No, nobody's talking about it.
No, the irony is it doesn't come on. The Grand Canyon ecosystem is a fundamentally damaged, fundamentally. Screwed up artificial Disneyland ecosystem. And for me to say that after spending 30 years of my life there is tragic. And it is heartbreaking for me to say that. Mm-hmm. But it's not a real river. You go to the Yampa River if you want to see a real river. You go to Desolation and Great Canyon if you want to see a real river. Grand Canyon is this fundamentally screwed up river ecosystem, which is still life's greatest recreational experience, where people's lives are transformed just because they go through what they perceive as death-defying rapids in the most awesome landscape on Earth, and they're alone with their friends for 7 or 18 days, and they do whatever screwy stuff goes on river, you know, and all of that. But it's got a screwed up temperature and empty eddies from sand and riparian vegetation that doesn't look anything like what it should. And the whole thing is screwed up. And I believe that in the eyes of most people, that's just fine. Just so, because ironically, the humpback chub have figured out a life history in which they can exploit this one natural place, the Little Colorado River. And as one GCMRC scientist said to me years ago, you know, it really... We can't really tell them this, but it really doesn't matter what we do with the dam. I mean, so long as the Little Colorado River is there and it's viable and all of that, it's going to be okay. Now, the reality is the Little Colorado River is subject to lots of development pressures itself. Right. What if the monsoons are failing? We don't have floods. There's a lot of bad things can happen there. But so I honestly believe I'm being... or particular with my words, whatever kind of a river ecosystem, however artificial it is, who cares, just so long as these target populations of endangered species don't blink out.
And that's what you're saying is the current sort of core...
I believe that is the consensus. Now...
And would you like to see a much broader vision for river restoration? Do you think it's even possible?
No, I don't think it's possible. No, I believe that the
What should we want?
No. Here's what I believe that may be all that's possible in Grand Canyon. What I believe deep down inside is that we do the American public a disservice by not telling them how screwed up it is. Mm-hmm. I believe that...
Because they're given false hope or
exactly.
for some other reason?
No, okay. Simply that. I believe that where we have made the mistake is that we fail to tell the American people. We fail to tell the citizens of Arizona, the Grand Canyon State, that there was an irreversible cost to the construction of Glen Canyon Dam. And there's an irreversible cost to large-scale water development in the Colorado River. And we're never going to get that back. And therefore, as we proceed into the future, we should be very careful about what new developments we make on the river. We should be very careful about which places we do want to protect, and that the disservice that we pay to the American public is that we pretend that Grand Canyon is restorable. Mm-hmm. And that is wrong. Mm-hmm. And that then what do we do now? We just absorb $10 million a year of a budget as the cost of doing business. And we never just say, you know what, this place is really completely artificial and screwed up now, and we're going to continue to make it the best we can.
Yeah, you're not saying we should just
We have a moral obligation. It's one of the greatest places on planet Earth. But we're also not going to decommission Glen Canyon Dam. So...
Never say never.
Well, that's a different topic. I mean, I've written on that as well. But the point is, I think that we have fuzzy logic or fuzzy-headed thinking, whatever it is, and we don't talk about the real issues in front of us. And we just pretend this feel-good, we're going to make everything a little bit better, and we're going to spend this much of our budget to study how much the wind blows up and buries archaeological sites on hillsides, and we're going to, you know, and stuff that's completely intractable. And that's crazy. I would say that the brave new world of climate change and the brave new world of decreased runoff in the Colorado River system will force our hand. Mm-hmm. That's how I end my talks, is I show those graphs and I say, okay, so we got to think big. We got to think like maybe it doesn't make sense to equalize the storage contents of Powell and Mead. Maybe it makes sense that we ought to re-drill out the river diversion tunnels around Glen Canyon Dam so that, that maybe it's better to fully drain Powell and keep Mead full. But I will also recognize that one can make utterly rational and reasonable statements about why it makes more sense to keep Mead full or Powell full and Mead empty. Hmm. I mean, well-intentioned, smart people make those arguments. And I'm not going to... But we need to increase operational flexibility. Mm-hmm. So that's the other big... That's the other big, enormous... issue. This is so wandering. This is the other big, enormous issue that the Adaptive Management Program and GCMRC are not doing now. They, the you know, the signpost saying, you know, we got a crisis coming are just all, you know, they're all blazing, right? Mm-hmm. And the interim shortage guidelines are coming in 2020. Mm-hmm. I mean, that this is what I'm working on. I've got collaborators who are working on this now. And so instead, so the stakeholders in the program sort of pushed GCMRC to develop an annual work plan that they're in now that's all about how to implement the L10 BIS. When, you know, it's like, how do you ski? You ski through the slalom gates. As soon as you know you're past the gate, you're looking where the hell is the next gate down the slope. And, you know, focusing the work plan on how to implement LTEMP is like focusing on the gate you just passed. Mm-hmm. The next gate is climate change and decreased runoff, mm-hmm. and changing water temperatures released from a much lower Lake Powell. Mm-hmm. And that's the big scepter. And the science questions that are going to be asked by of GCMRC 2 years from now are going to be all about that brave new world. Mm-hmm. And the science program needs to be focused on answering those questions. And that's all going to be about questions like, okay, we're now in the 20th year of drought. Mm-hmm. Maybe we want to selectively store all of our water in mead to preserve Vegas's water quality. I'm just making things up, okay? If we do that, then the water released out of Powell is going to be really, really warm. If the water coming out of Powell is really, really warm, is that going to constitute a short-term, easily reversible, temporary inconvenience to the ecosystem? Or is it going to cause an irreversible tipping point that will change the ecosystem forever after, such that everything that we've done in the adaptive management program for the last 20 years is irrelevant?
Would we get more of a river like it used to be?
Well, so the arguments you're going to get from different people, the answer is people will say to you, we don't know the answer to that.
Right.
And so I would submit we need to get our asses in gear to be doing the science to figure this out. Because I'll just take partial credit. You know, we all are, you know, I'm not unique in figuring this out. And so we, working with three of my old staff, three people who work at GCMRC right now, they figured out the models. We got three GCMRC staff, me and a fish biologist in the Upper Basin, and we got an article that's in Review in Bioscience that says how we make decisions about water storage will set the fate of all these river ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And we better be thinking about that. And if we don't have the science ready to go, mm-hmm. we better get... Because here are the arguments. You might say the most environmentally oriented among us would say, oh no, warm water coming out of Grand Canyon, that's just like it was in the old days. That's just the river of the 1950s. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. That's what we want.
With sediment in it.
And okay, and let's put sediment in. They would say that's the most wonderful thing. That's what we want. And ironically, every fish biologist at GCMRC plus a whole bunch of other people in Flagstaff who I don't need to make any more enemies on this tape, you know, would all say, no, no, the devil you know is much better than the devil you don't. We know that humpback chub are the largest population of humpback chub on Earth. is in Grand Canyon. And it might be the most screwed up ecosystem, but that screwed up ecosystem keeps the warm water predators away from the humpback chub. And it would be worse if the river was warm, because then the river is not only good for natives, it's good for non-natives. And the non-natives will eat the natives.
Non-natives being trout or something?
No, the trout are cold water predators.
Yeah.
Smallmouth bass, largemouth stripe or stuff like that. So that's the problem.
And they could move in if the water
they
warmed up.
Now, there's different ways to argue this.
Right.
And so the point is, when you put like-minded people as a... I've had a couple of these wonderful experiences in which we would write a scientific article, and then... So for us, it was like... I mean, those guys did great modeling. I helped them with the sort of so what of it and how do you write the discussion and all. And we had to nuance the discussion to not say the potential... Because their original draft of the article was the rivers are going to get warmer and that's terrible. And I'm saying, well, you can't say that because that's like what it was. You know, you at least got to say we don't know and we better get better science. Same way when Larry Stevens and I wrote an article back in the late 90s, and we wrote it about marshes in Grand Canyon, and as the most biologically diverse place in Grand Canyon were the freshwater marshes, except that they're an artifact of the absence of floods. And so we wrote in the discussion, well, the authors of this article actually disagree with whether this article is a big deal or not. Because you can either argue that this is the most biologically diverse and wonderful part of the Colorado River and Grand Canyon, or it actually shouldn't even be there because they never were there before. They only are artifacts of the dam, and who the hell cares about? So it's fun. Those are fun. Those are fun when you do that. But no, I would say that, I mean, I know we're out of time, but I think that what I'm, my mission is all about making decisions transparent. I mean, I personally would love a world that there wasn't a Glen Canyon Dam and I could float a boat all the way through. But that's not a world that my mission is not to get that back. My mission is to try to make all these decisions transparent in a democracy so that people make intelligent decisions about them. And yeah. So anyway. Yeah, what else? Yeah.
Well,
we're out. You got to go.
Yeah, a few more minutes. You did say one last question that I want to follow up on. You said earlier that there's a whole set of factors that go into influencing the ecosystems through the Grand Canyon that are off limits. So basically, hydropower is a whipping boy because
yes.
It's the only thing
yes.
that you can actually modify.
Right.
But that there are other more important
yes.
things that you can't modify.
Total flow.
Yeah.
Total monthly flow. Sediment supply. Temperature. And the new one that nobody had thought of that might be is nutrients.
And if somebody said to you, you know what, we're going to rethink everything.
Yeah.
You can adjust any of those factors in order to get more of what we want for the Colorado River ecosystem. Which of those factors would you go and adjust? And what would be the effect on the river?
Well,
hopefully.
So, okay. See, I always go back to the very practical thing. The first thing that I would do is we need to have a preliminary engineering, a formal preliminary engineering analysis of what it would cost to re-drill out the river diversion tunnels. So we at least know what the hell is the number.
Uh-huh.
Is the number $7 billion or it's $7 million?
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice to know. For instance, we know what sediment bypass with an existing reservoir would cost. there is a preliminary engineering analysis done by Reclamation. It's a number like 10 or 15 million. It's 250 or 400 million, depending on how you design it. I mean, it's a big number, but it's not billions.
Right.
And the annual operating cost for that pipeline is essentially the same as the budget of GCMRC, of the Adaptive Management Program.
That's
right. So it's a big number, but you know, right? So I would create operational flexibility. I would somehow get the brightest minds on the planet to figure out whether it really is true that it would be terrible to reinstitute a natural temperature regime and a natural sediment regime in Grand Canyon. Because I want to sound stubborn, but I just don't want to take that as the answer. Mm-hmm. It seems like a ludicrous answer. Mm-hmm. And yet I understand why so many aquatic ecologists and fish biologists say that. I understand their
argument. And not just the ones that want to preserve non-native trout fish.
No. These are well-intentioned people who care about endangered species. Mm-hmm. It's kind of crazy, and I understand their argument. I just keep saying, really, how can that be? Because, no, deep down inside, I would like to see in an imaginary world, I'd like to know whether it's possible that we can meet society's needs for water supply allocated to the most economically important places in the watershed and have a more natural Grand Canyon. But what that would take would be the ability to bypass sediment and bigger floods in drilled out diversion tunnels. Mm-hmm. Short of that, you can't do it. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to believe that's possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that a declining water supply might give us the opportunity. But at the same time, I recognize that you might do all that science and you might conclude that the thing that is the best public policy decision is the one that in my heart I don't really want, which is, you know, keeping powerful and me. But if it comes to that, I mean, you have to make decisions with your head. So I'm willing to let the chips fall where they may. But I just don't think we're working on enough. So getting bigger flows of the right temperature with an abundant sediment supply is the ultimate, is what you need. And all this tweaking with all this other stuff is largely just going through the motions.
That seems like a great place to end.
I'll never be, thank God I'm 67 and not looking for another job.
I think it'd be great if we could follow up with you a little bit later maybe see if we can drill down a little deeper on some of these issues that we touched on, but I think this is a good place to end. We've covered almost everything on the list.
Okay, and I apologize if I talk too long if this isn't...
No.
I don't know how you make sense of this.
I'm going to turn it off. Yeah.